My name is Stacy Fukuhara Barkley. I have a small law firm called the Children's Law Center. And I am married to Robert, and we also are writing a screenplay together called High Conflict about a Hawaii attorney, Lucy Ono, who's a child advocate, but she doesn't like children.
Hi, I'm Robert Barkley. First and foremost, I identify as a dad to my two kids, Ava and Nico.
How old are they?
Ava is 13 and Nico is 12. I'm also the chair of the language arts department at Windward Community College. I'm a novelist, short story writer, and just recently I've branched into screenwriting.
You know, how can you begin sketching for me? Maybe, Robert, you want to start in on this. Tell me about him.
Well, Ian had been teaching writing at University of Hawaii since the 1960s, so there were just countless writers who have gone through his classrooms. Some notable ones would be like Chris McKinney went through with Ian McMillan. And there's actually a book that it's about an inch and a half thick, which is dedicated to him, and it's written, there's about, I'd say, 50 stories in there from his students who have gone on to become published writers.
I was reading, you know, Rate My Professor on him, and his hotness level was 2.5, but, you know, one person said he really hones in on what needs to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that? How did he do it?
Well, one thing that Ian never messed with was content. He never said, well, you shouldn't write about this, you shouldn't write about that. But he would sit down with writers and say, okay, let's figure out what you're trying to say, and then we'll try to help you say it better. So he was never judgmental in looking at anyone's content. And even the students who were just taking his classes on a whim would be surprised when here's this guy who would sit down and spend an hour trying to help them write their story better. And he almost sort of shamed them into doing a better job on their stories. He just had a knack for helping people and a desire to see people succeed as writers.
I realize that everybody's got different things they need to work on, but, you know, there are certain elements maybe in writing that you can kind of, or like check a checklist of things mm-hmm. you have to get right. And it seemed like maybe details and dialogue are two things mm-hmm. that he really honed in on.
One of the strongest things I learned from Ian is the art of sensory description. He has a couple of like simple techniques, so where you spiral in on something or you can spiral out, and you're looking for a very specific, vivid detail. You know, you don't put a lot of them in there, but you need just one or two here and there that really transports the reader into a scene. And if you read anything he writes, you see these very specific, vivid details. And that was one of the greatest things that I learned from him, is how to do that.
How do you do it?
You use the eye. Like, mostly if you read a novel, most of the description is visual. There's other senses at work, but you can, like I was talking about, spiraling in and spiraling out. These were two of the techniques that he taught me. One is to start with a larger picture, and then you spiral in to a very specific, vivid detail. And then you can do it the opposite way. For example, you have a spear fisherman. He's in a cave, and you start with just the way the fish's eye looks at you in the cave. And then you pull back to show the cave, and then you have the fish being speared, and then the spear fisherman rising, and he breaks through the surface of the water, and your last detail is looking at the mountains, you know, a very large detail. So you could see how you could do that both ways. You could spiral in or spiral out.
How can you know what details are important?
Vivid. Yeah, I think you look for things that are unique and vivid, and it's, and you know, writing is imagination, and it's a muscle you exercise, and I think the more you practice at it, the more you find those very specific visual details. I'm looking at this board that I have here in front of me with all your little sound buttons, and I'm drawn to the fact that in the corner there's this little heart, right? And there's something that makes this daunting machine look very friendly because there's a little heart at the top. And it's called a pacemaker, and my imagination is going, could this thing save my life? So I think as a writer, you know, Ian was very good at this. You know, he would say, if you're in your car, turn the radio off and just look around, and you notice things. You'll find these very peculiar little visual details in your life, and they're worth noticing even if you're not a writer. You know, it's like, isn't that odd? This odd little butterfly, you know, that landed on something somewhere. So, yeah, it's nice to look at the world like that.
Someone said that he disciplined himself to write one story a month. Discipline like that is pretty rigorous.
His saying, if you want to be a writer, you need to be in the mail. And that means you have to have a story out there, you know, on a desk somewhere in a publishing house for someone to consider for publication. And he would tell his students, if you're not in the mail, you're not a writer. So I always try to have something in the mail. Otherwise, you're not a writer, or I'm not a writer. So I have a book. It's sitting on a desk somewhere in a novel I just finished last summer. It's sitting on a desk somewhere at UH Press. So I'm waiting to hear from them if they would like to publish it.
What's the protocol? I mean, don't you send them out to 200 publishers at once? Or is it just to one?
I just send it to one because I don't want to have to say to, you know, oh, sorry, because then I have to contact all the ones. I don't want to make somebody read it if they're not going to, if I'm not going to have them publish it. So, yeah, I just go one at a time.
I know the New York Times obit, Ian was quoted as saying, I am in the mail, therefore I am.
Yes, that's his mantra.
So he was all the way from the construction to the dissemination of the thing, a writer.
Yeah. He would help you write your story, and then he would tell you how to find places to publish it, whether it's in some obscure small literary journal all the way up to, you know, Random House or Penguin.
Did you have him as a professor?
I did. I took two classes from him.
Mm-hmm. What do you think you learned from him?
What I really loved about him was sometimes we'd workshop stories, and some of the stories wouldn't be that interesting, but he could always find one thing to get really excited about and to tell the writer to really expand on that. And then the writer would feel better and get excited. And from there, a lot of great stories were created. Just from finding one thing that resonated with him.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that always struck me, students would ask him, like, what's the trick to getting published? What are, you know, ways to pitch stories in your cover letter to a publisher? And he would say, the surest way to ensure publication is to write well. Mm-hmm. Write a strong story, and publication will take care of itself. So you put your attention on the craft of writing rather than on, you know, the tricks of trying to persuade somebody to buy your story. And so I always liked that advice. And so if I would get a story rejected, it wasn't, oh, how can I figure out a way to, you know, sell this, you know, in a cover letter better. It was like, well, no, let me sit back down and try to make the story better. So I always liked that advice from him.
But where does a story start? With what, a plot?
For me, ideas come, again, it's about looking at the world as a writer and just seeing where your imagination, takes you. Sometimes you're just having a conversation with someone and someone will bring something to mind and you can build a story around that. For example, I was talking with another writer about writing retreats, and we were talking about how silly they are, and they're all focused on meditation and yoga and allowing yourself to be vulnerable and all this, and we're saying, well, what about the writing? You know, how does this help anybody write? And he said, what you really need is to lock someone in a room with two angry dogs outside and say they're not getting out of the room until they produce something. And I thought, that's an interesting idea. So I'm writing a story right now based on, it's a humorous story, based on that kind of writing retreat where, you know, someone goes somewhere and they're locked in this very sterile room with an old typewriter and a pencil. And there's these angry dogs growling on the outside of the door, pushing them to write. So, yeah, little things like that. You get ideas, and then you try to develop them. I got tons of little, you know, false starts that didn't go anywhere. But they're still in a drawer, and if I figure out how to push them further, I'll go back to that.
One of the things he taught us in class was dialogue and how do you capture the essence of the person speaking. And he said, just kind of jumping onto what Robert said, one day he was sitting and typing, and he overheard his daughters talking on the phone, and they were using a Valley Girl voice. And he said he just stopped and he listened to them. And from there, a story grew out of it, you know. And he had us practice using different voices. He'd say, find your favorite author and, you know, your favorite character in the book, and then imitate their voice. How would they say something? How do they look at the world? And that was really helpful.
What might be some other assignments that he gave? How would he start people?
I think he said your subconscious, you know, is at work. So when you're doing a first draft, you don't question what's coming into your head. And you can write a lot of nonsense. And like what Stacy was saying is like, then go back and look at it and see what little kernel of brilliance is in there, and then go back and start polishing that. I don't remember him ever doing a lot of exercises. And, you know, he would focus on story and say, you know, you write a story and then let's look at it. And then you figure out, well, what is this story trying to say thematically? And then you go back and you start revising the story, saying, okay, how can I make this theme more apparent in the story? How can I adjust, you know, the plot points so that theme becomes more apparent in the story? So he was very much focused on process, like that revision.
How did you, I know Malal, it didn't start off, you know, as a masterpiece, and you said
that's Robert's
yeah
book.
And yeah, you said that Ian found something and said, this is interesting, expand on it, and then from there something grew out of it. Is that?
Yeah, I had written a couple of short stories in his classes, and two of them were focused on my experiences in the Marshall Islands. And he pointed out that these two short stories are kind of connected in a way thematically. And that's how I ended up writing the novel. I put those two short stories together and built a whole novel around them. They were, you know, one story was about an older man, and another story was about some children. And so I made the older man their father, and from there the novel took off.
What was the theme?
Well, the novel is about the legacy of nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands and the apartheid practices of the U.S. military, particularly at Kwajalein Atoll. So the novel is basically a day in the life of this Marshallese family struggling against the U.S. military's oppression out there. And the novel also delves into, you know, thematically using Marshallese mythology to explain the way evil works in the world. And then I have chapters from the perspective of some American children are trying to make sense of all this living out there, and they're just trying to have a good time, but there's all these weighty, you know, global issues swirling around them. It's set in the 80s during the Cold War.
You know, having all these elements and getting them to not seem to flow, to getting them to flow is really a trick, isn't it? Mm. I feel like I just finished reading a book where it had the details, it had some scoping back, it had it was a mystery, you know, it carried the smell of the person through the whole thing, but it felt very like, how shall I say, formulaic. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. How can people get away from that when they're doing the checklist?
Well, for me, I don't like formula in anything. I mean, there are certain things, I don't know if you call it formula. You should have a protagonist that wants something, who's struggling against something, but that's about as formulaic as I'm going to get.
What else should you have?
Well, I think if you want to make a lot of money, you follow the formula.
What is the formula, actually?
Well, you start with a protagonist. Uh-huh. They want something. You throw a bunch of obstacles in their way. You have a strong antagonist or bad guy, right? And then at the end of the story, the good guy defeats the bad guy and gets the girl, right? You can write that story any which way. And that story will make money, whether in film or in a novel or a television series, I think. But I always try to do weird and odd things in my writing. So I don't know if I'm going to be the most commercially successful writer in that respect. Hmm. But that's the kind of writing I enjoy, and that's the kind of reading that I like to find, or movies that I like to see, the people that do things different, that experiment, that try new and different things.
Hmm. How would you describe, we talked about him as a teacher. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to say about that, about him as a teacher and what it was that he, you know, uniquely had for writers here?
He was just a very sincere person. There was no pretense with him. He was honest and quiet and patient, and overall just a very decent human being. And if you look at the books that he writes, he's very much concerned with human cruelty and why people do cruel things to each other, and how do you remain a decent person yourself, you know, living in a world that's full of cruelty. And I think it's one of the things that struck me about him, is just what a good, decent person that he was.
Be interested in his conclusions there. Mm-hmm. How? Why do we do it? How does it happen?
He wrote a lot about this in a series of books about World War II, looking at human cruelty, human depravity. And in his latest book, In the Time Before Light, his final novel, there's a passage, and it reads, on the face of every man I have ever seen commit an act of cruelty upon another man, I have seen in the tightness of his jaw an expression of conviction of his justification and the rightness of what he was doing. And you see this all over the world. We want to think of evil as something like, you know, Darth Vader, right, or Dr. Evil. But in reality, people who do horrible things, what he gets at in his fiction is they think they're doing the right thing somehow. And that's what makes it very sinister and very frightening, is that people are doing cruel things for what they believe are the right reasons. And so he explores a lot of that in his fiction.
Oh. How timely.
Yes, and he explores it historically, and it's so appropriate for the present. We still see it, whether it's genocide in Africa, whether it's someone, you know, shooting, you know, 500 people in Las Vegas, what is wrong with these people? And what Ian is pointing out is that if you were to get inside their heads, somewhere in there is the justification of the rightness of what they're doing, which is what's really frightening, that they would believe in the rightness of what they're doing.
Tell us a little about the latest book. In the Time Before Light.
Well, this is a novel that's set in the between the late 1700s and the early 1800s. And it's about this British merchant who arrives in Honolulu with all the biases and prejudices that a man, you know, coming from Britain would have at the time. He's fascinated with the quote-unquote natives and, you know, the way they fought in wars and so forth. And he meets this Hawaiian man, Pono, who speaks perfect English. And at first he thinks it's some sort of parlor trick. But as Pono tells him his life story over the course of the novel, Matthew, who's the British merchant, finds out that not only is Pono more intelligent and more moral than he is, he's also more worldly and more traveled than he is. And the bulk of the novel is Pono's life story. It's this. He's kidnapped as a young man by this pirate who's fascinated with human depravity. And for decades, they travel around the Pacific Rim from one side of human atrocity to another, trying to figure out why people do that. That's the story of Pono that Matthew listens to. And at the end, it's beautiful in the way they find a way to preserve their own humanity in a world that is so cruel.
Would that also apply to the 21st century?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We're just surrounded by atrocity and depravity. And, you know, what is the answer? I mean, it's as simple as, you know, a Beatles song, I guess, right? All You Need Is Love. But that is, and you see this in Ian's work, that is one of the hardest things for human beings to do, is to love one another, to feel compassion, to feel empathy. That takes work. It takes a lot of effort. And hatred and cruelty comes very easily. And that's, you know, a tragedy of human existence, in that it's hard to love, in that it's also easy to hate.
What condition did the manuscript, was the manuscript in when he passed away?
It was a completed manuscript. He had revised it several times, and before he passed away, I had several communications with him, and the novel right now is broken into chapters, but it wasn't when he handed it to me. But I had a few conversations with him about how to break it into chapters. So, you know, the book went through a standard editing, you know, process, and then I broke it into 24 chapters, and then we have this Carl Pau, who's a Hawaiian artist, who's a friend of the McMillan family, let us use this beautiful art for the cover, and so we put the book together and put it out.
Who's we?
Me and Stacy, who owns Lo'ihi Press with me. We have a small publishing company. We've published, I think, five, six books so far, sporadically here and there over the last, 12 years since we started the company.
Wait a second here. How retro of you. Start a publishing company. So what's the idea here? Maybe you can say, Stacy.
You know, it's just so hard to get published in Hawaii. You know, especially since, you know, you send your book out to the big publishers, and unless it's in New York or California, set in New York or California, they're thinking, that's not really my audience. So we really wanted to encourage local writers or Pacific Island people who write about the Pacific to write and to submit their writings and, yeah, just kind of foster that.
How do you get their writings?
Well, so far it's just been word of mouth. I have the book I published before this was Free Love by Sia Figuel, who is a Samoan novelist, so she approached me, and we made the book. So it's just been about personal connections. We've never published a book that was anonymously submitted, and it's an incredible amount of work, and it doesn't, you know, publishing Pacific, Hawaiian Pacific fiction, there isn't a lot of money in it. So it's an entirely a labor of love to put out these books. And so that we put out so few because we're so small, and it's just an incredible, I mean, this Ian's book, it's, you know, 500 pages, you know, to edit and put this together just, you know, for a couple of people, it's an incredible amount of work.
How long did it take?
Oh gosh, this book was in the making for about, I would say, 8-9 years I had it, and I would work on it a little here and there, and I would pass it off to a friend of mine, Mark Panic, who teaches at UH Hilo, to help me with the editing. So it was just a slow, steady process to put the book out.
And as a publishing company, let me think, what do you do? You get it, you know, ready for printing, and then where was it printed? How many were printed?
Well, this book we printed through before we would had it printed. I think it was the last couple of books printed by a factory in Minnesota, and then we held on to the stock, and then we worked with a distributor. But that almost costs money every time you sell a book. By the time the distributor takes a cut, the store takes a cut, and then there's nothing really left for the author or for us. So my new model is I don't take any money from any of the authors, and I don't make a dime. So I just do it all.
How is that an improvement on the
But we don't lose money.
Yeah, so this book I used, Amazon has a service called CreateSpace, and so it's a print-on-demand service. So it doesn't cost any money on my end to print the books. And so they'll distribute the books to bookstores, and they'll sell the book online at Amazon.com. And so that's our model. And so all the money, in this case for Ian's book, since he passed away, the money just, I had a bank account set up, so every sale just goes to his family.
How about the previous book?
Same thing. Sia Figuel, I put her book out, and I, again, set up an account, and so every sale, it goes straight to her.
This doesn't sound sustainable.
No, it's not.
It's a hobby.
Like I said, it's a labor of love. I like putting out the books, so it's not a money-making enterprise. And really, selling fiction, unless you're on the New York Times bestseller list, you're not going to make a lot of money selling fiction in the first place. Now, if someone were to call and say they want to buy the option to make a movie, there may be some money there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gee, I mean, local writers, what are you saying about why write?
I think if you have a story, I mean, and you want to tell it, and if you can find an audience that will read it, that's the success. I wouldn't measure success in like how much money you're making off a book.
How do you get people to read it?
You go on Hawaii Public Radio and you talk about it.
Hope this works.
Yeah, so I had we had a launch party for the book. The book was reviewed in Honolulu Magazine. There's a book review upcoming in the Advertiser, or was it the Star Advertiser now? And then I'll probably submit it for the Kapalapala Pa'okela Awards. You know, simple marketing strategies like that. And then you hope word of mouth. And I pass the books around to college professors, hoping they'll use it in their classes.
We need to get people excited about reading again. That's a real problem. I mean, the bookstores are closing. People are finding Kindle. You know, they'll read on Kindle, but it's just we've got to rejuvenate that love of reading, you know, going to the library and looking at the different books and just getting lost in the stories and in the characters. And, you know, until that happens, yes, it is very hard to sell books here.
Mm-hmm. You know, you'd think that never have people been talking about storytelling as much as now. Everybody's mm-hmm. got a story. Every soft drink has a story. Mm-hmm. You know, but people don't read as much.
Oh,
what?
I encounter that in my creative writing classes. I get students who say they want to be a writer, and my first question is, well, what do you read? And they say, well, I don't have a lot of time to read. I say, well, if you wanted to play the ukulele, do you think you should probably listen to the ukulele to see what other people are doing? And, you know, a little bell goes off in their heads. But, yeah, I think people now more than ever just – there's so many other options to get storytelling, whether it's through video games or television series and so forth, that reading just doesn't seem to be as popular an option as it used to be.
And look at you now. You added screenwriting to your
mm-hmm.
thing.
Uh-huh. I think you if you can get something made, you'll reach a larger audience that way. And it's fun. It's a fun, you know, I've just been doing it for a few years now, and it's just a different way of writing, a different way of trying to tell a story that's 100% visual.
Hmm.
Well, Creative Lab is a state of Hawaii program, and the intention is to accelerate the global export of Hawaii's creative content and creative products to strengthen our creative entrepreneurs' capacity for success. Basically, Robert and I submitted a screenplay to Creative Lab Hawaii. We are hoping to get a television series made, and we were chosen for the program. And it's a year-long program. So it starts off with a 5-day retreat where we workshop our stories.
What does that mean?
Well, there's... So this year, I believe there were 8 fellow cohorts that were chosen for this program. And there's 3 different categories. One is a 1-hour drama, a 30-minute sitcom, and a feature film. So Robert and I got into the 1-hour drama, and we just workshop our story with the whole group.
And a coach.
And we were fortunate enough to have Jesse Nixon Lopez, who was a writer on Stranger Things. And she was responsible for the character Elle. And so we worked with her as well. We had one-on-one sessions. And she just helped us to, there's so much we didn't know. It's so different from writing a book.
What kinds of things would she say?
For instance, you know, in a book you can cheat and you can have interior monologues to kind of get to know your character better or to portray who your character is. But in film, it's all about showing. So she said, well, do this exercise. Get into your character's head and, you know, write what they're thinking about this particular scene. And then I did that. And then we were saying, none of that has been conveyed on the page. So it helped us to go back and say, okay, well, she seems really stressed out and she's thinking about things on several different levels. And so we just went back and we revised and revised until we were like, okay, that matches the interior monologue. Another thing we learned is that there's something called beats. And Robert can explain it better than I. It's very it's basic, but it's also complicated. So I'll let Robert explain it.
Well, in a TV series, you're going to have an A story, a B story, and a C story. I think if you've watched television, you can see where, okay, here's this character's story, and then you have a minor character's story. And just breaking down your script and looking at how it's structured. So you have, okay, we need an A story beat in the beginning, and a B story, and you just want to make sure everything's balanced throughout the screenplay. So the way Jesse showed us how to do this was just using simple, cards with, different color cards so that you could see visually the balance of the beats in your screenplay. So that was a really good exercise for breaking it down and then restructuring the screenplay so that we would have, like, for example, a minor character story might need to be introduced a little earlier in the screenplay. And you could just see it visually because that story is blue and another one's yellow and another one's red. And so that you could put it all up on a board or down on a table and you can see how your story is structured a lot easier that way.
Oh, that is so helpful, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Huh. And so what else? What did you emerge with?
Well, we took that. We started with a pilot episode, and then we revised that and until we had it in pretty good shape. And then we beat out the entire first season of the series, which is just the beats, not writing the scripts for the entire shows. And then we...
The beats being just sort of key.
Yeah, the high points.
Yeah,
yeah, right. So you got A story, B story, C story, and then we submitted a pitch to the American Film Market conference, and I think it was about 800 people submitted pitches, and then about 15 were selected, and we were one of them, and so we were up on stage in Santa Monica in front of about 750 writers and industry people, and we got to pitch our TV series there, and it went really well. The audience responded very well to our pitch. They laughed and applauded. It was a great experience.
So what happened was towards the ending of our year-long program, the state chose two TV writers and two film writers, and they sponsored us to go, for us. We were chosen for the American Film Market, and that's where 90% of the world's movies are. The people there represent 90% of the world's movies, and so as part of that, one of the conferences was a pitch conference, and so 400 people submitted video pitches about their show. It's a 2-minute video pitch, and we were chosen, and so that was probably the best experience because we got audience feedback, because it was a lot of industry professionals there, and our three judges were industry professionals, and we felt so good because everybody laughed and everybody kind of would say aw at the appropriate times because they were being kind of harsh on a lot of the people. And we realized we have something that appeals, even though it's set in Hawaii, the characters are from Hawaii, everything, it appealed to a broad audience. And that was a nice connection that we made.
Hmm. Why did it appeal?
I think because it was just a funny, endearing story. It wasn't so much, it was set here and... Even though we have all of that, it was just, we made them laugh. And nowadays in this environment, I think people just want to laugh.
And what they were laughing at is the interaction between our protagonist, Lucy, the attorney, and her interaction with her dorky boyfriend, Todd. So I think that we did a really good job of that in the screenplay, and we incorporated that into the pitch. Mm-hmm. And we were really nervous getting up there. And so, when we started the pitch and when the whole room exploded with laughter, it was, wow. It's like, maybe we have something here. Uh-huh.
So it was dialogue driven in that.
Mm-hmm.
Very, yep. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I think we didn't realize how much the two characters we were talking about had in common with us. Everyone else touched upon it.
You guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were like, no. But I think so when we were presenting together, it really brought another dimension to it. And so people really responded well.
And what's next?
Well, our big lesson, what we learned, was that the business of producing films and television has changed so drastically that the big distributors and production companies, they're not looking, it's kind of like books. They're not looking to spend, you know, to put out millions of dollars and hope everything works out. They want as finished a project as possible. So they're going to ask you, well, who's connected to your script? Yes, I like your script, but who's connected to it? Are there any big producers? Are there, you know, famous actors? Because they want it to be as big a, they want it almost a guarantee of success. They don't want to stomach all the risk. And so it's kind of like with books. That's why we do books on demand and print it, because we don't, you know, a big part of it was having to order 5,000 books and spend $10,000, and we may or may not recoup that. And I think that's so. Another thing we're starting to get into is we're going to try to produce a web series. A lot of it is we're realizing we need to depend on ourselves, our cohorts in the Creative Lab program. And that's why the Creative Lab program is so important, because we're all realizing that we can't do it alone. We're not going to submit a script and someone's going to say, I love it, I'll give you $10 million.
And do everything else
right,
for you.
Right, right. We have to put in the hard work, and that takes a community. And so...
So you mean meeting videographers, meeting actors,
right,
that kind of thing?
Right. And there is a community, and that's what Creative Lab's trying to harness here. And so they have a we entered the writers program, but they have a production immersive. And those are, that's the next step, where you're actually producing the film. And so they teach you the business of it, and they teach you, you know, how to do it. And so we got to meet some of those people, and we're saying, hey, we have a script, you have a camera, you know. And so to kind of...
Wow, that's amazing. That's how you grow capacity.
Yes.
And come up with a product at the same time.
Yeah, one of the, my friend Vili Heronico went through the producer's immersive with Creative Lab, and he's producing my novel Malal into a feature film. And he just recently got a production deal with two companies, one in Australia and one in New Zealand. And they're looking to start filming next summer.
And he made that connection at the American Film Market.
Yeah, when he went there as part of you know, Creative Lab.
Oh, with his film?
Yes.
The Mauna Kea?
Malal.
Malal, my novel, Malal.
He said Malal there.
Yeah, so he ran that through the Creative Lab Producers Immersive. And then when he went, when they sponsored him to go to the American Film Market, that's when he met the... Australian producer and the New Zealand producer, and out of that they made a deal to make the film.
Wow, finally you're going to cash in on all that creativity, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's an indie film. I don't know how much money, you know, like how much money indie films make, but they like the story, and they're going to make the film.
Is that what writers really hope for these days?
Me not. I mean, with my screenwriting, yes. But when I write, if my novel never gets made into a film, I'm happy with that. I'm invested in the novel. I'm happy with it as a novel. But yeah, the end goal is not to write a novel and then to get the novel produced into a movie. For me, the novel, you know, writing a good novel is satisfaction enough. But yeah, it's great that someone's going to make a movie out of it.
Sounds like that Creative Labs thing is pretty good.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It's amazing. It's run through the Department of Business and Economic Tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing this because if they can have a flourishing film industry here, that brings in a ton of revenue for the state already. I believe... you know, there's about $300 million a year in revenue coming in to Hawaii for, you know, shows like Hawaii Five-O and movies. And so they're really looking to grow that industry.
But growing a local
yes.
component of
it. Yes, not just the production here, but really, or the filming here, but local writers, local actors, local producers, all of it.
You know, say you're just, you have a story you want to write. What should you do? Take a community college class in creative writing?
That's interesting that you asked that. Yes, you should take a writing class. You should learn the craft. Where I teach at Windward Community College, we're developing a creative media certificate now. And we're going to have three tracks, one for documentary filmmaking, one for creative or narrative filmmaking, and one for video game design. And we're looking to – it's going to be very intensive so that over the course of a year, a student can learn how to write and produce their own content. So we're really looking forward to getting that up and running.
That should funnel people pretty well into the Academy for Creative Media.
Yeah, and we've already had some great successes. We have one of our students just got her own show with ThinkTech Hawaii. Another student, the film that he made as part of our program called, his name's Sky Bruno, he created a film called Shape, and he submitted that to Sundance, and they accepted him as part of their Ignite Fellowship, which is a year-long intensive fellowship on teaching him filmmaking.
So, oh, gosh, that's super. I interviewed him because of that.
Yeah.
I happened to see it, and I just thought it was really good.
Yeah, so he made that in our video production class at Windward Community College. And we have an excellent teacher in Kim Basford, who's a documentary filmmaker herself. And so she's leading our creative media program. And, she's going to do a fantastic job. And I really envision lots of great successes coming out of that.
Hmm. How's enrollment in your creative writing classes?
I have one creative writing class this semester. It's just for fiction writing, and that's about full. We recently added screenwriting classes. I'm not sure the enrollment on those, but they've been pretty good. But as we create the certificate in the next year, all those things will work together in the certificate, and we'll have a track and a sequence for students to go through. And so it's going to be – we'll have to do a lot of marketing, and then hopefully the enrollment will go up. What I love about Hawaii is that it has its own literature. It has its own music. And I'd like to see the same thing with film and television. I think we should have our own television series. We should have our own films, that we shouldn't have to go through Hollywood to get things made, that we can do it all here, much in the same way that we do with books and music.
What's going to be key here is the state is helping us. They're helping us get started. I mean, the program that we're in, the director, Michael Palmieri, he's thought about these things for years. How do you develop an indigenous community, you know, for film or a community that writes about itself? And, you know, some of it is state sponsorship. You know, networking. We also work with the Guild, the Writers Guild, Screen Actors Guild of America. And we're developing little communities. It's like little huis. We're getting together. And I think that's kind of where it starts. And like Robert said, you have to write good stories. And then we have to just cultivate it, get people here excited about reading again and about, you know, watching movies that are made here that are great quality. And that's going to be some marketing too. We're going to have to do a lot of marketing. And so that's part of what we're learning. We're learning how to market ourselves. And it's very different now because for instance, for us, we were told that if you want to get your series made, be proactive. Start doing a little web series, but you got to be able to market it to people on different platforms. So we're having to learn about all of that, and that's how you create buzz. And then from there, people actually, you know, someone may want, if they see you're successful, they may want to buy the rights and get you a TV show. So it's about really just doing a ton of research on your audience and how to market to your audience. And it's just so different now. Mm-hmm. It's all social media platforms, all of that.
And producing spec material.
Yes.
That you can send out there.
Right. And being very specific as to where you send your things to. Now the whole thing is know your audience. Key in on that and advertise only to them for the most, at least to start.
And you've only got so much energy and resources.
Right. And that's why the whois are important.
Mm-hmm. I read that Macmillan said, let your imagination go, but start with what you know.
Yes.
You know, for all the people growing up here, I would think they would like to start with some local material somewhere.
Mm-hmm. 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 It's interesting you brought that up. The dedication in his book, In the Time Before Light, is to our imaginations. And I think that's, you know, what's going to save our species. And I think Ian taps into that in all his books. It's the power of the human imagination to overcome our faults.
Gee, you guys, this is great. Thank you
so
much.
Oh, you're welcome. This is
Thank
fun.
You.